This is the Human-Centric Investing Podcast with John Deal, where we look at the world of investing through the eyes of our clients. Take it away, John.
Hello, financial advisors. This is John Deal, Senior Vice President of Strategic Markets at Hartford Funds. Welcome to episode 18 of the Human-Centric Investing Podcast. Joining me today is Stephen Boswell, President of the Oxley Institute. Welcome back to the podcast, Stephen.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here with you.
Well, today we're going to talk about the word of mouth influence hierarchy. Now, we've created a workbook for this content that you can access in the show notes, or you can go to hartfordfunds.com/influence. Again, that's hartfordfunds.com/influence. Also, we've got Stephen booked for a September 12th webinar at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. So mark your calendars. And once again, that's September 12th at 4 p.m. So, Stephen, I've heard of word of mouth influence, but what is the word of mouth influence hierarchy and how did you build it?
Yeah, well, the hierarchy is our way of putting some order around some of the ideas and research we have on how to generate more referral flow as a financial advisor. So we always have a lot of ideas around that topic. We've done a lot of research around that topic, but this hierarchy, a pyramid of sorts, is the best way we've come up with in terms of how to explain it. And it, you know, part of it is that it's sequential, and there's some things you have to do before others.
And tell me, Stephen, I know the Oxley Institute has been around for a long time. Tell me a little bit about the research that you conduct and how it kind of culminated in this word of mouth influence hierarchy.
Yeah, the research has been going on for 20 years, and it's split into two camps. We do a lot of research on financial advisors, and we'll focus on things like how do they market their practice, how do they service their clients, what are they doing with social media, and that's continued up until this past year where we researched 404 financial advisors as part of this project, trying to figure out specifically what are they doing with regards to word of mouth. So as part of that project, we figured out who are those who got the most referrals every year. And then what were some of the behaviors that led to those referrals? And that's where this model is based. On the other side of it, our research on the affluent hits it from a different angle. We're looking at people with between 250,000 investable and about 10 million investable and trying to figure out how they find financial advisors, what factors into their loyalty, how are they interacting with their advisor on social media, really just the mirror image of the advisor project. And it forms the foundation of models like this and all the coaching and training that we do.
So I know, Stephen, in the workbook, like the first image that we see or one of the first images that we see is the pyramid. And if you could you walk us through briefly, and then we'll go in more in depth, obviously, into what the four areas of the pyramid are and why you structured it as a pyramid?
Yeah, well, if you go from the bottom up, so if you can imagine for the listeners out there, a triangle-shaped model, it's a hierarchy. On the bottom, the base level is exceed professional expectations, meaning doing a good job for your clients. The second level up is emotionally connect, basically having beyond a business relationship with them, getting to know them on a personal level. The third tier up is activating conversations, hugely important in terms of stirring the pot, getting them talking about you a little bit more actively. And then finally, the tip of the iceberg here is refining the narrative. So if you've got your good clients, they're happy with what you're doing, you're connected with them emotionally and personally, they're talking about you, what are they saying? And so we've got some strategies for helping refine that conversation so they're speaking to the right bullet points.
And it's a pyramid, Stephen, because I think you mentioned just a few moments ago that one builds on the other, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if you were to start from the top and start refining the narrative, you wouldn't have a lot of success in getting more referral flow, because if you're doing a lousy job for clients professionally and you don't know them real well personally, there's not a lot of word of mouth happening. And so we recommend, if you're starting with this process, start with the bottom. Make sure, good and sure, that you're exceeding professional expectations before you move up the ranks of the model.
And, you know, the other image I see in the workbook is it looks like a bell curve almost of kind of categories that you call laggards, middlers, and generators. What is that all about?
It's the way we were segmenting advisors in that research project based on the number of new households they brought in by way of referral in the prior year. So if you're a laggard, laggards are 22%, so the left edge of that bell curve. These are people who brought in between 0 and 2 new households by way of referral. Not very good results. The middlers were the 55% in the meat of the bell curve who brought in between 3 and 9 new households by way of referral. And then the generators, where we focused most of the research efforts, were those bringing in 10 or more new households by way of referral. So we find most people are fitting into that middler camp, and with some fine tunings, with some changes, could be moved up into generator. If you're in the laggard category, if you're the 22% who's bringing in really no new households by way of referral, it's a clear indicator that the base end of that model isn't as tight as it should be for you.
So let me ask the obvious question, right, from the advisor who kind of takes a glance at this stuff and says, I don't get it. Why don't advisors just ask for referrals? Why do I need a system? Why do I need some kind of framework to, why don't I just ask? What would you say to that?
Well, you could look at it with a hypothetical at first and say that if you're one of these people who'd be considered a laggard and you didn't bring in any new households by way of referral last year, or very few, if you just started with a marketing mindset first and you said, you know what, I'm just going to ask more proactively, I'm going to ask anybody and everybody, the results wouldn't be very good. And here's why. When we research the affluent, we ask them their feelings about that approach. Really, how do you feel about being asked for a generic referral? And every year, you're in the neighborhood of 75% to 80% who say that approach makes me in some way feel uncomfortable. I'm being put on the spot. The advisor is saying to me, who do you know, basically, who has money, who isn't happy with their advisor, and who's not going to be put off by me, this pushy salesperson, being on their trail? And it tends to shut the conversation down. So while on paper it would make a ton of sense, just ask everybody. There are some building blocks that have to take place before they're going to be good advocates for you. And the way in which you ask for that advocacy matters. And so we spend a lot of time, and we will in these podcasts, talking about how to activate conversations the right way. So when you think about it, let's say you're doing a good job professionally, you know and like your clients, and they know and like you, and it's time to kind of stir the pot, time to activate conversations. There's some tactics that have more finesse than those traditional referral approaches. And that's what we're going to spend some time talking about.
So I think the first thing, Stephen, right, would be to look at your own practice and say, look, as I move forward, referrals is something that I want to build, right? Because I meet advisors who say, nah, we're good there. You know, we got enough organic growth or so and so. Well, you're probably not the advisor then interested in this. I would think we're looking for an advisor that says, I would actively like to grow the number of referrals that I get this year. And it sounds to me like what you're doing is maybe applying a bit of intentionality married with a bit of a process to this referral process, right? Rather than just asking a question.
Well, yeah, exactly right. Because a lot of people look at it and say, you know, if you were to look at all the different buckets that advisors might use to find new clients, you'd say referrals coming from clients. You would say alliances with other professionals, maybe client events, maybe socially prospecting in the community. The one that has the most impact, but the one that gets the least structure and attention, is the referral flow. Because a lot of people think it's either happening or it's not, and there's not a lot we can do about it.
Good point. Well, with that, let's dig a little deeper into the word of mouth influence hierarchy. And we described those 4 levels, but I want to start, Stephen, at the base level, because it seems like in that base level, which you've titled Exceed Professional Expectations, that there are some things you want to make sure we have in line before you even begin to think about the referral process. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And we tend to look at it on 2 different angles. We look at it from a communication standpoint and a financial services standpoint. And you'll notice in the worksheet, we've gone through 14 criteria that have come from our affluent research that really speak to what they're looking for in a financial advisor. So when you're looking at exceeding professional expectations, this is a little bit of a scorecard.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you're asking, and look, in all of those 14, there's usually something we can pick out. See, you've broken them down into both the kind of the financial piece, but also the communication piece. And I think it's important to think about our practices in both of those contexts, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that every one of these is a work in progress. It doesn't matter if you're a brand new advisor or someone who's been in the industry a long time and seen great levels of success. And these, I'll just go through a few of them because I think they're important. And when, just to give you a little bit of background, when we ask these from the affluent, we don't ask them about these 14 and say, how important are these? We ask them about a much broader list of categories, and they come up with basically, these are the 14 that are most important to us. And some of these sound like kind of common sense, but aren't executed all that well by many financial advisors. So under communication, you might say, you're looking at one of these, that being a good listener and understanding their family sounds really basic, but how well are we doing that as a team or an individual advisor? Someone who's overseeing the totality of their family's finances, not just the investment arm. Someone who's being personal in the communication. I mean, just things that are basic, but get overlooked. They get taken for granted at times. When you're looking at the financial services side of it, yeah, making them fully aware of fees, helping them create and keep updated a financial plan, making sure you've got the latest technology, and just stuff that, you know, should be at an A-plus level if you want them to be really good advocates for you.
So, Stephen, do you try to fix everything at once, or are there usually, in your experience, a couple of things that jump out at the advisors to say, yeah, maybe it should be these two or three areas? How do you recommend we think as we're looking at those areas and questioning about our own practices?
What we tend to find, we work with some great teams. Just from a coaching standpoint, we see some big producing teams, some highly functional teams. And what you tend to see with them is they know how much they can bite off at any one time, but they're always working on something. And I always find that really interesting, that there's never a point where, like, you could put a team, let's say there's team A that has a lot of production, a lot of team members. You can put them through an assessment that analyzes all aspects of their business, and they could really dissect this business and come up with 25 different things they could probably be doing different or better. But they know better than to try to accomplish all those things at once. What you find is that week by week, call by call that we have with them, they're always looking to fine-tune and change something. So you look at a list like this, and it might be tempting to say, well, gosh, we have a lot of work to do in half of these categories. Well, why don't we narrow in on the sleeve of providing insurance solutions, because we could be more consistent with that? Or why don't we narrow our focus for this next quarter to the technology? And what you find is that if you're consistently working on something over time, you've got a real competitive advantage based on that cumulative hard work.
And Stephen, you mentioned in our workbook that generators tend to provide a stellar in-office experience for their clients. And I got to tell you, in my own travels, I've seen this again and again and again, but it's oftentimes overlooked. What do you mean by providing a first-class in-office experience, and why is it so important?
Yeah, I think that's one of the more interesting parts of your job, John, and some of the more interesting parts of my job, too, is when you get out to some of the individual offices and you get to see that experience firsthand, from how you're greeted at the door to the beverages you're offered when you sit down to just the overall comfort and atmosphere and just the feeling you get when you walk into some office versus others. And you can walk into some branch offices and have a very sterile, unfriendly environment. You've got squawk box on the TV. You wait in the lobby for a little while. It's just not all that pleasant. Whereas when somebody's really got this, as we would call, first-class in-office experience, you know from the minute you walk in the door that it's going to be a comfortable, enjoyable conversation, and one that you'd look forward to coming back to. So examples of that might be, I walked into an office last year where it said on the whiteboard when I walked in, "Welcome, Mr. Boswell." And it had a picture of a hand-drawn, this was a whiteboard, logo of Appalachian State, because they knew that's where I'd gone to school. I didn't even know this team, but I thought, what a nice touch, and I liked them immediately. You know, advisors, just those who put a little bit more time and attention, seem to have an easier time getting clients into their office for reviews, which we know is mutually beneficial.
I agree that creating that remarkable client experience has tremendous impact, differentiating one advisor from another. One other question for you, though, Stephen, is how can advisors use feedback to exceed professional expectations?
Yeah, there's a section in the worksheet that offers some specific language. I would encourage everybody to look through some of that, because feedback, yeah, we can talk about the importance of it, but how you go about asking for it is really the key. First of all, that you do ask, because I know it's a scary thing to do. You're putting yourself out there a little bit to say, hey, directly, am I doing a good job for you in certain categories? And I'd like your feedback. It's kind of scary to do sometimes, because you're worried about what you'll find. But if you look at this as something that is, you know, just from a totally self-serving perspective, you've got some really bright clients, And if you engage them the right way, they're going to help you build your model more effectively. And we outlined some really key times to ask for feedback, because it ought to be really specific, both in when you ask and what you're asking about, if you want it to be helpful. So it's kind of the opposite. If you're looking to, you know, to improve your service model, for example, you don't want to ask a client at the end of a review meeting, hey, how are we doing? Everything okay? Because you're not going to get a whole lot of helpful information, and it doesn't come across as very sincere. Whereas if you're saying, perhaps at some point near the beginning of the meeting or midway through, hey, let's take a breath for a second. I wanted to ask you about one specific element of our practice that we've been tinkering with. How do you feel about the number of reviews we're doing every year? Right now, we've got you set for 3, and we've just tinkered with whether or not to increase that or decrease it. What are your viewpoints? And so you're asking about something really specific that might help you make better decisions within the business.
I think especially if you thought about those different categories of things, right, the 14 criteria, yeah. And you identified a couple. I mean, think about targeting a specific area about the kind of technology you're using or how someone feels when they walk into your office. You know, we've been evaluating that process. What are your thoughts? Is there anything more we could do? It comes along the personalization angle, right, that I really do care about what you have to say because you're a very important client of ours.
Yeah, exactly. So they get that message that, hey, I'm looking to improve. I want your help because I think you're smart and I value you as a client. And we outlined some other ways you can ask too. So we said, here are the categories when we think it's important. When you sign a new prospect, when somebody signs on with you, you ask for feedback about why they chose you, what ultimately won them over, because you want to know which of your selling points was most important. You want to ask for feedback from people who didn't decide to go with you. You know, what led you to go in a different direction? Uh-huh. It might be helpful to ask at a mid-year review, just about something specific. Like you mentioned, John, one of those 14 criteria would be perfect. And, you know, when you lose a client, obviously, it'd be great to get some feedback about what really led them to move. And, you know, if you're systematic about this, you end up getting better.
Absolutely. So, Stephen, let's move up the pyramid. Let's talk about the next section up, which is emotional connectivity or emotionally connecting with my clients. And you mentioned a Harvard Business Review study about the importance of emotional connection. What's that all about?
Yeah, I mean, when you hear the term emotionally connect, it sounds like a Harvard Business Review term. And that's exactly where we get it. It's one of those publications you read, and half the time you're like, man, they've made this way too complex. But there's some really smart folks, and they come out with some good concepts, as long as you can dumb it down for us commoners here. But Emotional Connect was a good piece they put out. This was back in 2016. And it actually had some implications. They had done some research on the financial services industry and the impact of what they call being emotionally connected with your customers. So the headline here was that emotionally connected customers are 52% more valuable than highly satisfied customers. And they said basically, you've got an ideal client when you're emotionally connected. They buy more from you. They're less fee sensitive. They pay more attention to your communications and following your advice. They recommend you more often. And this study mirrors a lot of the work that we've done over the last 6 years in terms of advisors who've got business/social relationships with their clients as opposed to being all business. And very, very similar findings that when you take the time to get to know them beyond the numbers, you learn about their family, their interest, you connect with them beyond your work together. They tend to want to help you by way of spreading the word about you. So this one is incredibly important. And when you look up the hierarchy, the base level, that ought to be just a hygiene factor for advisors. When you're looking at exceeding professional expectations, I mean, that's why you're doing what you do, right? You want to be good at your craft. Even if you're not in a growth mode, you want to be good at your craft. But as you move up the hierarchy, this is where you start to see some of the laggards and the middlers tail off here. They're not quite as good at emotionally connecting, and they're not systematic about it.
So, Stephen, you've outlined 8 methods or 8 ideas. Now, obviously, you know, we can never say it's an exhaustive list, but I'm assuming that these are 8 ways to emotionally connect that you have found have worked for advisors. So why don't you touch on these and just briefly describe them?
Yeah, and it's one of those categories, John, where if there's a will, there's a way, and the desire has to come first. That you can look at our research, or if you trust Harvard a little more, you can look at theirs and see that when you do take the time to get more personal, both when you have somebody in the office and when you're engaging them outside the office, that it does have a ton of impact, and we can show you mountains of data that points that out. But you've got to have that desire to do it first. And then you find all kinds of ways to get personal with people. We've thrown about a little bit of a hodgepodge of ideas here. And I'll also share with you, what we would say are some of the core activities. If you look at a core activity, if you're one of our clients, we would recommend you take clients out for non-business or social lunches. That sounds so simple. But if you do it systematically, and by a social lunch, I mean, if you were my client, John, I would call you and say, hey, John, it's been a while. Would love you to take you to lunch just to catch up on life. I'm not bringing any paperwork. Where would you want to go? What's your favorite place?
Yep.
And if I'm doing something like that with, starting at the top end of my client base, if I'm doing that even once a week, we can have some really significant impact over the course of a year for something really, what sounds really small. So as a core activity, yeah, you can't go wrong with just something casual like a social lunch or breakfast or dinner. Other activities, we'll talk a little bit about how to activate conversations using intimate events, but that has a very similar impact on emotional connection because part of doing a small event with clients is getting to know them on a human level. We also offered some skill advice on this page 7 of the worksheet in terms of slowing down. Uh-huh. If you're rushing from one appointment to the next and you've got a very stacked day, it's really hard to take a breath and ask, so John, tell me what's new with your family, or where are you guys headed for the 4th? I mean, things like that we know we ought to be asking, but it just slips off our plate if we're rushing from one appointment to the next.
Nothing more harmful to be asking those questions as you're looking at your watch, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or ask it on their way out the door. Hey, so what's going on for the 4th? It's like I'm clearly making small talk. You know, it's interesting, and allow me a quick digression here. When we had done our research around getting social with clients, and we looked at some advisors who did that really well and others who didn't, there was a real disconnect. A lot of the advisors said, no, I get social with my clients. And a lot of the clients were saying, yeah, not really. And the disconnect we find is a lot of times the small talk that happens in the office, and that counting is, let's check the box, I've emotionally connected. Where it doesn't really, the clients don't perceive it that way. If you're on the way out and somebody's asking, hey, you got any plans for the 4th? It's basic small talk that's not quite as intentional as it should be. And it doesn't showcase that you really do care about the answer.
So Stephen, we, in the workbook we included, and I know our time on this podcast is drawing to a close, but the next couple of minutes, could you explain the Know Your Clients worksheet that we put in the workbook and explain how advisors might begin to use that, what the purpose is?
Yeah. If you were looking to score how if you were looking to rate or assess or score how you are emotionally connecting with your clients, you'd often be able to do that by determining how much you know about them. So if I've gotten to know you well over the years, I would know, where do you like to eat dinner? What do you do for fun? What are your kids' names and ages? And what we find is that if we're systematic about not only having those types of conversations, but documenting what we find, we're able to really get to know these people and profile them over the years. Now, the worksheet that we offered, it provides some fill-in-the-blanks for putting, pets' names and children's names and hobbies and interests about your good clients. And you can use it in worksheet form and write in and fill in the blanks, or you can take some of these same fields and put them into your CRM. The medium doesn't matter a whole lot, but the process matters greatly. So if you're really thinking about every conversation with a top client as an opportunity to add something to the Know Your Client worksheet, over time, boy, do you get to know these people better.
And oftentimes it comes about just by relating it to something in your own personal experience, right? So, for example, if you own a pet, talking to the client, leading into a conversation about an experience that you had with your own pet, and then being able to say, I never asked you, do you own a dog? Do you own do you have any pets at home? And people, you'll know whether it shuts down right there, or usually people that are pet people will go on for quite a long time about their pets and how important they are.
Yeah, and think about the power of having profiled that stuff over time. So that, let's fast forward. Let's say you have that conversation, John, with a client, and you uncover that their dog, Rusty, is a Shih Tzu who's 9 years old, and they're still working on potty training, and he has a hard time going outside, right? Something, some quirk about that dog. Let's fast forward a year later. You bring it up in conversation of, hey, I've been meaning to ask you, how's Rusty been doing? as opposed to saying something generic like, you got any plans this weekend? I mean, right. You're showcasing that you paid a lot of attention, that they're important to you.
It's this kind of information that allows an advisor, I think, to personalize that relationship, which is important. Well, Stephen, we've run out of time on today's podcast, but I know I'd like to encourage everyone listening to continue to look for our next podcast, where we're going to complete talking about the structure of the hierarchy, the next two levels. Stephen, thanks for your time today.
Hey, enjoyed it, John, as always. Thanks for listening, everybody.
And thanks again to listening to the Human-Centric Investing Podcast. We'll talk to you all soon.
This podcast is intended for use by financial professionals or in conjunction with the advice of a financial professional. It is intended to be educational in nature and should not be construed as individual investment advice or a recommendation or solicitation to buy, sell, or hold any security or to adopt any investment strategy. It does not constitute legal or tax advice or fiduciary advice pursuant to ERISA rules.
The Oxley Institute is not an affiliate or subsidiary of Hartford Funds.